You know, I remember even just 5 years ago, being in a meeting with some people of color, and we were talking about the importance in the city's climate work of getting transit out to areas where there was affordable housing. Problem we were trying to solve is, how do you get transit to areas where there's affordable housing? And many of these individuals said, well, we also need to get housing to where there is transit today. Like, and in my mind, it was only interested in one part of that problem, which was, you know, in my mind, a city's climate action plan was about expanding transit service, mm-hmm. not addressing expanding affordable housing like that. And I remember saying in that meeting, well, this is a climate plan. This is not an affordable housing plan. That's a different plan. That's a different department. Now I can't believe that I said that. Like, I'm just like, it's so obvious that absolutely that's part of the solution, is to get affordable housing where there is existing transit service.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline.
We have Michelle Krim, the Chief Sustainability Officer at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability in Portland, Oregon, in the United States. Welcome, Michelle, to the show.
Thank you, Alfredo. I'm happy to be here.
A good place to start, I think, is talking about the mainstream sustainability field and movement. What are your thoughts on that?
So I've been doing work in that field for a long time, over 20 years, close to 25 years. And, you know, it's what I went to school for. And most of my career has definitely been about doing sort of these types of things that I learned about in college. And there was a certain sort of just a way that you did things or issues that you paid attention to and addressed. And I spent most of my career just really focused on those things. And, you know, things like being focused on things like how many, you know, carbon emissions we're reducing, or how many kilowatt hours of renewable energy are being produced, or, you know, what a certain concentration of a type of pollutant in the river might be. And it's been in recent years that I think I've started to really understand and see the connections between those things, but the larger systems at work that are creating those outcomes or those results, and seeing the need for the environmental and the sustainability fields to move more towards addressing those larger systemic issues, and not just trying to fix things at the end of the pipe, as they say, in terms of environmental issues. And I think the other thing that I've learned in recent years really is, often what I learned about in school and what I did for much of my career wasn't about people. Mm. It was about the environment, sort of, but it was like the physical manifestation of those things, and it was mm-hmm. always largely absent people. And so that element of it, I think, is something that is new to me and is a different sort of evolution of the mainstream environmental field.
Yeah. What's interesting about what you're mentioning is that you went through education, and there were some things that were taught to you about sustainability. And what I'm hearing from you is that not everything that was taught to you, you're actually working on now, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know, given that there were some things that you were not subject to in a curriculum, what are the 2, 3, or 4 things that you're doing now that were nowhere in a curriculum and you were not made aware of until you either engage with people, because you're getting into people now, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily something you're going to see in a mainstream sustainability curriculum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I was in school, the things that I learned were, well, and maybe it was also, I think, a large part of what I went to school for. I got a degree, my undergraduate is in geology, so it was definitely not focused on people. It was focused on, you know, what happened millions of years ago that you can understand through looking at rocks. And so it was definitely very physical science. Mm-hmm. And then in graduate school, I did more environmental science, which felt more of a softer science to geology, but it still didn't involve a lot of people. Like, there might be some fish or some wildlife thrown in, you know, to what we were looking at in my classwork or what I was studying, but the people component of it wasn't really there, and there wasn't really much in the curriculum around understanding cities and urban environments and the role that those concentrations of people have in terms of both impacts on the environment, but also where some of the solutions might live. The things that have shifted for me that have opened me up to that, I think, is it's largely been from people that I've worked with, and yourself included, and some others who really have helped me to broaden my perspective and see the linkages between the systems that affect people, whether it's displacement or housing affordability or having good jobs or access to healthcare, that all of those things are intertwined with the environmental and climate and sustainability systems, and often the systems that are creating those environmental crises we're trying to fix are the same sorts of systems that are causing these other issues as well. And to be able to see the linkages and to understand that by working on addressing some of those impacts that are affecting the humans can also help us to address the environmental impacts as well. So it's mostly been not through what I learned in school, certainly, but what I've learned since then from working with people who saw those things and probably, you know, have seen them all along, and just opening myself up to being able to start to see those things as well and to understand how my work needs to be in those spaces as well.
Yeah. So to be clear, we're talking about people of color, indigenous people, frontline communities is really who we're talking about, right?
Yes. Yeah. Because I think whatever we can do to address the impacts that are happening on those communities will benefit everyone. But if we're just focused on more broadly the impacts to people as a whole, we're going to miss addressing those impacts that are affecting those frontline communities. And so that's definitely the priority. Mm-hmm. And should be the priority, I think, going forward for what cities and organizations and nonprofits and others are doing to address sustainability and climate issues, and what should be taught in school.
Yeah. You said something, and I want to come back to it. I really appreciate one thing you do, which is when you're faced with complex issues like poverty, houselessness, mental health issues. These are all complex issues, drug addiction. When you're in such complex spaces, I think the problem solvers of the world try to put it into something they can manage and troubleshoot. And I don't see you doing that as much, at least I haven't experienced you doing that. Well, what are the things that you needed to do to come to a place? Because that's an important key attribute to have as a leader of an organization that, you know, we'll get to talk a little bit about the climate action plan, but how are you able to get into a headspace where you do less of that?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. It's an interesting observation. I haven't really ever thought about myself in those terms, or I think I'll spend some time reflecting on that and thinking about where that maybe came from, or because I'm not sure it's always been that way. You know, I remember even just 5 years ago being in a meeting with some people of color, and we were talking about the importance in the city's climate work of getting transit out to areas where there was affordable housing. Problem we were trying to solve is, how do you get transit to areas where there's affordable housing? And many of these individuals said, well, we also need to get housing to where there is transit today. Like, and in my mind, I was only interested in one part of that problem, which was, you know, in my mind, a city's climate action plan was about expanding transit service, mm-hmm. not addressing expanding affordable housing like that. And I remember saying in that mm-hmm. meeting, well, this is a climate plan. This is not an affordable housing plan. That's a different plan. That's a different department. Now, I can't believe that I said that. Like, I'm just like, it's so obvious that absolutely that's part of the solution, is to get affordable housing where there is existing transit service. So I don't know that maybe I've always been that way. I think I slip back into old habits pretty easily, but I do try to hold a space where you can explore all of those things and try to find those linkages. And then I think the challenging part is then to understand what specifically folks who work in this department or who work for me, like, what is the action that we can take that can make an impact in those areas? So I think I'm still probably trying to find the solutions, but being more open to that those solutions could look a lot different than maybe what we would have conceptualized before.
Yeah. And I think what you're alluding to is a journey, right? Mm-hmm. A learning journey. And it sounds like you've had an opportunity to learn from community members about how they experience the work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to learn from them and to, you know, it's important. I've learned the importance of not just listening, but to valuing those perspectives and to understanding that the expertise within those communities to find the solutions, that they are closer to the solutions, and that it's my job and my responsibility to listen and to value that and to lift that up and to take action based on that, and which I think goes further than just sort of letting somebody tell you their idea and then dismissing it. And so I've been working to try to continue that journey so that I can really make sure that I'm doing that and that I'm coming into those conversations with frontline communities and really lifting up the solutions that they already know are the solutions to the problems that we face.
There's going to be a lot of youth that are going to be listening to this podcast. And I remember the first time that I met you, I was just out of school feeling like, could I really do this thing at local government and the institution that put together, you know, the best climate action plan in the world? So what would your message be to youth who are aspiring to work with you or engage with you? What are some things that you would let them know that I think you started to get at it? They bring value, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you just share a little bit about what that looks like for you?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels with youth and sort of what I was just expressing around what I've learned in the journey that I'm on around valuing and engaging with frontline communities in this work. I haven't had the opportunity to do it that a lot with youth, but I've been thinking about that a lot, especially with several things, including just sort of seeing the leadership that youth are taking today in multiple fronts, on particularly related to climate change, along with gun violence and all sorts of other issues, that the power in that and how high the stakes are for youth in terms of those issues. And so I think it's a similar, for when I think about my work and the work of the city of Portland in that space, it really does need to move towards finding ways to create opportunities for youth to come forward and to have agency in helping to develop and find the solutions to these issues, and to actively seek that out and create those opportunities. In part similarly, because I think youth are going to have new and different ideas, and it's important to not say, well, we tried that, you know, 20 years ago and it didn't work, or like to be dismissive of what they bring to the table and the solutions that they see, because the world is really different today than it was 10 years ago and than it was 20 years ago or 25 years ago when we started working on climate change here at the city of Portland. And so what that work looks like and needs to look like going forward is very different than what it's been in the past. Mm-hmm. And so those voices and those perspectives of youth, and particularly youth of color, I think are critical. And we need to create space for that and actively seek that out and lift that up.
Yeah. So let me touch on the climate action plan, because I think that will spur us into the next conversation I want to have, which is more like forward thinking. The climate action plan, which was recognized as the best in the world, it's been interesting for me to hear how people experience that, especially outside of Portland, because it's referred to as the best climate action plan in the world. And I was having a chat with one of our colleagues, and this person let me know that they think the plan has more impact outside of Portland than inside.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we did get this award, and one of those reasons was because equity is mentioned in the plan. Does it live up to its hype? Or clearly it's a pivot. It's a start of a pivot, but how are you experiencing it right now?
Mm-hmm. So I think both of those observations are correct. One being that Portland's Climate Action Plan, I think, is more well known and recognized as being impactful outside of the city, outside of Portland. And in part, I think that's in because compared to a lot of other climate action plans that cities do, it's pretty aggressive. It's pretty comprehensive. We've been doing it the longest, so we have a long track record that we're able to point to and show results from. So as others are trying to figure this out, Portland sort of rises to the top as a model for that. A lot of people here in Portland probably don't even know we have a climate action plan, or if they do, they don't know what's in it, and they probably don't care what's in it, which is fine as well. But it's more well known outside. When we get a lot of speaking requests or presentations or other things, and mostly those are coming from outside of Portland. in terms of that label of best climate action plan in the world, I think at the time it was different than any other climate action plan, in part because it was really the first city climate action plan that did begin to articulate the equity issues associated with the work. But that was, we developed that, you know, let's say in 2012 is when we were doing that work, and I think our thinking on it has changed considerably. So I look back at it now and I'm like, well, it was a start. It wasn't quite just giving equity issues lip service, but it was pretty close. So it was better than what had been done before, but now we know it's just not nearly good enough. But I think it was where we were at the time. It's where frontline communities were at the time. And now I think both the city and those communities are in a much different place. And mm-hmm. So what we're going to be able to do going forward and what the climate plan, but more importantly, the climate work will look like going forward is going to, I think, be considerably different. It still isn't going to be enough, mm-hmm. but I think we're going to take some pretty big steps forward to make it even that much more transformational. And because Portland is seen as this international leader in this space, the promise that there's an opportunity there to then influence how lots of other cities around the world also shift their climate work right. to center communities of color and underserved communities. And so I think there's a huge opportunity and responsibility that we have to create a new model for how to do this work that others can follow.
Yeah. I would just like to hear from you the importance of taking the time to understand the context and the past before moving forward, because more often than not, you know, we started this episode with the mainstream environmentalist sustainability also as an example. A lot of times people move forward to just have this vision of this utopia, right? Mm-hmm. And they start working on ideas to getting us to that utopia. How has understanding the history of Portland and really diving into that, how has that been vital in you before moving forward in work?
Mm-hmm. I think that's really critical to understand that history and context to move forward, because it's the foundation upon which we're building. It's the reality here in Portland. That history is our story and our context, and the context for frontline communities that if we're looking to engage and more than engage, really co-create what this looks like going forward with those communities as an institution, we need to really deeply understand that history, I think, so that we can find a path forward together and to acknowledge the role that the city, this department, has played in that history. And I think it maybe relates to what we were talking about in the beginning, is because it touches on all of those interrelated systems. And mm-hmm. so if we're hoping to address issues around transit ridership, that it's not just about having more buses on the street. There's so many other layers, and there's a lot of history and context there about why the buses are where they are and how frequently they go, but also who feels safe getting to the bus mm-hmm. and being on the bus and waiting for the bus, or, you know, like there's just a lot of history there that shapes that. And so to the extent that we can try to embody that, and the work is really important. And I think a piece of the history that we're trying to be really intentional about with what we'll be doing going forward is the history around the Native community and their history here as well. I think often when we think about Portland's history, we go back so far, and, you know, sort of these thousands of years of history here in this area and stewardship of the land that we're wanting to make sure that we're also incorporating into how we think about how we move forward. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but it's all part of the fabric within which we need to build going forward. And to understand where we want to go collectively, we need to acknowledge and own where we've been in the past and mm-hmm. try to, in moving forward, repair some of that harm.
Yeah. So, yeah, what does the future look like now? We're all gearing up for this next phase of climate action. I know folks in the community that are not going to call it climate action per se. Mm-hmm. Do you have any initial thoughts on what the future looks like in the next, you know, 5-6 years? Because I, for one, when I think of climate action, I see education as climate action. I see getting youth in gangs out of gangs as climate action. Mm-hmm. I also see allowing women who live in multifamily units an opportunity to have a job at home, maybe recycling materials as climate action. Mm-hmm. So that's not in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So like,
yeah,
it's a balance, no?
Yeah. Well, and so I think, you know, what you're hitting on there is, I think the space we're trying to move the city's climate work into, which is that it's more than and bigger than and deeper than the sort of superficial things that we often think of as climate action. And so what we're planning to do, we'll be updating our climate action plan for towards the end of 2020. So we'll have a new plan. Hopefully, instead of the best climate action plan in the world, it'll be the best climate action plan in the universe. And what what we're striving for is to really break open what you were just describing, that all of these other things are climate action, and that to get to the carbon reduction goals that we need to get to in order to avoid catastrophic climate change is going to require us digging down to the root cause of a whole bunch of things that are creating those emissions and that are going to be preventing us from achieving those emission reductions. So we have been thinking about, how do we center the priorities and the wants and needs of frontline communities, and how do we start the conversation there? So when we're talking about things like health and resilience and prosperity and being able to, you know, have a job or those other things that you were mentioning, if we're centering that as the organizing principle for the city's climate work, what are the actions that we would be doing in our climate action plan that would help us to achieve that, that would also help us to build resilience to climate change impacts and to reduce carbon emissions? And in the past, we've typically focused on how do we achieve the carbon emissions, and then we'll sprinkle some equity around the edge and make it maybe less bad or less harmful to those communities, or make sure we provide a little more access to some of the benefits for those communities. And that's typically what it's looked like. And so we're trying to see how we can flip that on its head and start from how do we deliver the most impactful benefits to frontline communities in the areas that are a priority for them, and then how do we sprinkle carbon emission reductions and that around the edges. And we think that in doing that, we will actually be able to unlock greater carbon emission reductions than we would have been otherwise. So, so going back to the bus example, there's a difference between a climate action plan that says we need to increase transit ridership to 80%, and we're going to do that by throwing more buses out there. If nobody's riding the buses because there are all of these other issues, either the buses don't go to where they need to work, they have to, you know, wait an hour and a half between buses and then they're full, or they don't come at all, or they don't feel safe walking to the bus and there's not sidewalks, and there's all of these other issues that might prevent us ever being able to achieve that 80% of people ride, you know, take transit. We have to figure out how to address all of those other issues, or we're never going to get there. And so I think our climate plan, the vision that we have for it going forward, is to begin addressing some of those other systemic issues and being able to call that climate action.
So I'm hearing that just adding equity in a climate action is not necessarily mean that there's a outcomes that are positive for all.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So I'm curious then, because I was trying to maybe get you to talk about what those solutions are, because I named a couple that came to my mind, right? But what I'm hearing is that you're more focused on making sure that we have the systems and dismantling the systems that don't work. So how are you able to work in a way that's transformative in the institution as well as not prescriptive to the community?
So we've been thinking a lot about that, and I don't know that we've figured that out yet. But when I've been thinking about it, I think it is going to require a couple of things. And one is that it seems to me that there's a bit of a push and a pull, that we're at this point in time where we're evolving the city's long-standing history of climate action into something new and something better. And in order to move through that transition and that evolution, we have to sort of push and pull our way through that. And I see that communities of color, frontline communities, are well-positioned to help pull us through that. And by that I mean by helping to shape that vision of where we're headed and what that what that different future looks like by centering those communities and helping us to understand where we're trying to get to, sort of what our North Star goal is. And then there's a lot of work to be done to, so if they're sort of pulling us, and then there's a lot of work to do to push the institution into that transition as well. And so that looks like, you know, what are the things that we can do to help, for example, city staff who have built careers around doing climate work in the traditional way, the mainstream way that we've always done that. And how do we help push them into new ways of thinking and new ways of doing their work, and how can they then help us push others, our external partners or other institutions? And so it's this blend of pulling and pushing that I think that the institution and staff and others can work on from the inside, and that the community can help lead from the outside, and that together, if we can find a way to bring all of that together, ideally through the processes that we develop in order to update the climate action plan, we might be able to move into that transition space as to help create that evolution. And so when we think about what we're going to try to do in for 2020, it's really about, you know, whatever the plan is great, but what's more important is the process, and the process for community, and the process for staff and practitioners in the institution, so that we can both move together into something, a new paradigm, really. And building that new paradigm together is the work ahead.
Yeah. So we're almost closing down this first episode. One question that I've been meaning to ask you, and it's more on a personal level, is that, as you know, I'm from Peru, and I want to do climate action work and sustainability work in Peru, which is an exciting feat that I don't think I'm fully ready for yet. Hence, I came to Portland. And so I'm wondering, you kind of touched on it, is that here in Portland, climate action work is going to start to look like the community leading the work, right? In my mind, I'm thinking, you know, there's sisterhood programs where cities will pair up with other cities to help each other out and lift each other up. What are the milestones, or what are the things that need to happen in order for work that the city, because you mentioned the city of Portland has a track record, you know, we've been doing this 10 years now. So at some point, it's a global issue. It's not a Portland issue. Mm-hmm. We work under the boundaries of Portland. But what does the world look like if all of a sudden Portland was doing climate action? What does it look like globally?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really interesting question. And I think that cities, those urban centers are, there's so much opportunity in the urban centers around the world to lead on these issues. And that's where a lot of the carbon emissions are coming from. And that's where a lot of the carbon emission reductions are going to be found. And so cities around the world are working together in various venues in order to advance that collectively, and to share with each other, to steal from each other and replicate the best practices and the actions and the policies, so that as a whole, we can collectively, all of these cities around the world, make a big difference. And there's different organizations that help to facilitate that. One of them is called C40. And then there's the Carbon Neutral Cities Alliance, which is a bunch of cities with really aggressive carbon goals. And there's lots of examples of that. One of the challenges is that a lot of the cities in the Southern Hemisphere actually are not necessarily actively engaged in those networks and don't have access to those resources. And so I think one of the challenges and great opportunities is to find ways for a lot of those cities who work together pretty frequently, typically in the Northern Hemisphere, to find ways to partner with cities in the Southern Hemisphere, both to help provide resources, but also, I think, to learn. It's the same thing, right? That we're trying to do here locally, where though the perspectives and the experiences and the history in those cities in the Southern Hemisphere are I think, vital to helping us solve these issues worldwide. And a lot of the most catastrophic impacts of climate change are being felt in those communities already. And so I think it's incumbent upon cities like Portland to not just be thinking about what's happening here, but to be thinking about how do we leverage what other sort of cities who are similarly positioned to us are doing so that we can have a greater impact, but also how can we learn from and also help those cities that are already feeling the impacts and are going to be more heavily impacted than we are here in Portland.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I guess that's an invitation for us to work together in the future,
right? That's
right.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Because I think there are things Cusco could teach Portland, just like Portland could teach some things to Cusco, you know?
Yeah.
So now that we're wrapping up, we got a chance to talk a lot about work. And I also know you're a very wonderful person outside of work. Do you mind just sharing how you like to spend your days in Portland? And I know you also have a blog you write. Mm-hmm. This would be a great time to give a plug into.
Yeah, I think similar to maybe the journey that I'm on to try to, as a as a white cis woman, to understand my power and privilege and how that shows up in my work and how I can use that to affect change in the work that I do, similar to what we were just talking about. I've had a similar journey just in my personal life, both on that issue and then also just with my health. And I spent most of my life not being very healthy, and I wasn't active. I was morbidly obese for most of my life, and so in recent years have gone on a similar journey just to try to find a way to lead a life that's full of adventure and health. And so I spend a lot of time with friends and family outside, being active, hiking and running and trying to take care of myself, mostly so that I can travel. And international travel is a passion of mine. And I like to not just travel, but do really kind of fun and crazy adventures when I travel. My husband often teases me that if some activity requires that you sign a liability waiver about that they can't be held responsible if you get killed doing this activity, that I'm the first person to sign up for that. And I think that's very true. And so I have a blog that's called alifemoreextraordinary.com. And in that blog, I sort of chronicle my experience with my health and how I got healthier, and then also all of the travel and adventure that I like to do now that I'm able to physically do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me in this first episode. It's been a pleasure to both work with you and have this chat to hear a little bit about who you are and the work you do. Again, we have Michelle Krim, the Chief Sustainability Officer at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability in Portland, Oregon, in the United States. And it's And any last thoughts you'd like to share with folks that may be listening to this?
Mostly I'm really excited that you're doing this podcast, and I look forward to listening to your episodes, and I think continuing to learn from you and learn through your curiosity. One of the things that I've loved about getting to know you and getting to work with you is that sort of insatiable curiosity that you have about people and about the world and about how things work and how to fix them and break them and, all of those wonderful things. And so I really look forward to listening and learning along with you.
Folks, welcome to my community. I am really excited to get started and speak with different leaders across industries. If you have a second, please check out the website www.climatefrontline.com, where you can find out more about the podcast, about myself. You can also suggest future guests for the show and questions you may want to ask in future episodes. So I am excited to get that going. Thank you so much. The communities who are experiencing the worst effects of climate change are those who are best positioned to innovate solutions. Thank you for tuning in and being part of Changing the Narrative. See you next time at the Climate Frontline.